talking about live.
Hello and welcome to the Pain Cave. My name is Jay Friedman. I am your host, and I'm very excited to be joined this morning by most definitely the smartest and fastest person we've ever had as a guest on the podcast. Welcome, Alex Hutchinson. Alex, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on the show, Jay.
No, it's my pleasure. I'm deep in the midst of finishing your most recent book, and it's blown me away. And I just wanted to have you on because this really kind of gets at a lot of the things that we like to address on this show. And you have a really remarkable perspective on it, and I really wanted to talk about it. So for those of you out there who aren't familiar with Alex, as I said, without a doubt, the smartest and fastest person we've ever had on. Alex is a doctorate in physics, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Physics long ago in the past.
And also a former runner on the Canadian national team, mostly at the mile. And currently, Alex is a writer. He's been a writer for quite some time. He's a contributing editor at Outside Magazine. He's a former columnist at Runner's World, which is, I'm sure, where many of us came to know his work from. And he's the author of three books, the most recent one. And the reason we wanted to talk to him today is called Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. Alex, this book really is, I'm going to say, one of the two or three best nonfiction running books I've ever read. But it's not just a running book. It goes into many different endurance type pursuits. I mean, you touch on not just the attempts to run sub 2 hours by some of the Nike athletes last year, but also Ernest Shackleton on his expeditions to the South Pole and some of the fatal attempts to reproduce those expeditions. You talk about cycling and a wonderful chapter on Jens Voigt's hour record attempt, which Jens was one of my favorite cyclists ever, as I'm sure many people have that opinion. So it really gets into a lot of different aspects of endurance. But most importantly, the power of the mind and the nervous system in terms of regulating endurance performance, both at an athletic level and just in general. When did you kind of realize the importance of the mind in terms of how it relates to endurance performance in your own running or just in general?
Yeah, so there's various sort of stages of awakening, but I think that when I think about it, I trace it back to a race I had in college, which is more than 20 years ago. I was a sort of mid-level college or mediocre college runner trying to break 4 minutes for 1500, and I was stuck at that level for like 4 years from high school and through most of college, running like 401, 402. It was kind of like reliving the John Landy experience, except for 1500 instead of the mile. building up this barrier. So I really had this sense that I was kind of pushing up against my limits. That the fact that for 4 years I was running just over 4 minutes, I thought, okay, I know I can run 3:59, but that's probably about as much as my body is capable of doing. And I had this one race where it was a totally small, meaningless race where the timekeeper just was calling out the wrong splits, and I didn't realize it. So I had the impression that I was going way faster than I normally would, but with no additional effort. Like it was an indoor race, so it was like he said 27 for the first 200 and 57 for the 400, which is ridiculously fast, and I felt really good. And I just had this feeling that's like, this is your Alex, you were having the greatest day of your life. Don't waste it, don't screw it up, stop listening to the splits and just go. And I ended up running 3:52, which was a 9-second personal best, which for a mature runner who'd been training hard for like 5 years was ridiculous.
At a mile distance, yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, and so yeah, exactly. You know, nine seconds in a marathon, maybe not such a big deal, but for a 4-minute race, it was huge. And afterwards, you know, I found out from my teammates, like they're like, "No, you didn't go out in 27 and 57." The timekeeper either started his watch at the wrong time, or he was having trouble translating from French to English because this was in Quebec. And so for whatever reason, he had tricked me into thinking I was going really fast, and so I had kind of left behind whatever was holding me back, and. I mean, the postscript is just as interesting, which is that, you know, I never again struggled to break 4 minutes. And in fact, in my next race, I ran 3:49. And in the race after that, I ran 3:44. So it was like, it was a total transformation. I was a completely different runner after that one moment. And so from that point on, it was hard for me, no matter what, I experienced in a race, it was kind of hard for me to think, oh, well, I must have hit my physical limits or I went as hard as I could, because I had this knowledge there that's like things can change immediately based on something that's happening in your brain. And, you know, I've looked at my training logs. You know, I'm an analytical guy, so I've analyzed my training logs more times than I care to admit, trying to figure out like what was the magic behind that transformation. And there's nothing in the training logs that kind of hints at it. So, in terms of the feeling that there's more to it than VO2 max and lactate threshold and running economy, it probably goes back to that experience. And I think that's probably why I ended up kind of still picking away at this topic, you know, even when I came back to it as a journalist, a decade or more later.
I love that story from the book, and it really, I mean, it's an amazing breakthrough, but it really does kind of bring into relief just how much we can be kind of limited by our expectations. And once you kind of remove that limit, it kind of opens up a whole new world. And you mentioned Landy, and you mentioned this in the book as well, that, you know, he was kind of banging on this 4-minute door for months, if not years. It was probably 18 months of kind of running between 4:01 and 4:03 over and over. And then once Bannister broke it, it seemed like the floodgates opened for him. But you make the point also that it's not just that. Like, there were a lot of other things that contributed to maybe him not breaking it. One of them probably being just the thought of this as such a mental barrier. But also, you know, he wasn't running the same competition. He wasn't, he didn't have the same training knowledge that Bannister had developed. And then when he came over and started racing in Europe, all of a sudden he started breaking it. And if he had done that 2 months before, maybe he would be the person that we would all talk about instead of Bannister.
Yeah. It's interesting because the danger or the human tendency is always to go from one extreme to the other. So it's like, because I'm saying it's not all about VO2 max, it's tempting to flip the other way and say, it's all in your head. And if you believe, you can achieve.
Right.
And so I really wanted to bring out that context to the Landy story, that it's like Landy had been running in crappy weather, solo races on bad tracks in Australia, running 4:02. He finally came over to Europe. For the first time, he had a local pacemaker, and he had competition. He had Chris Chataway, who was one of the guys who paced Bannister.
He was Chataway, eventually the Olympic champion at the steeplechase, isn't that right?
I think Brasher was.
Oh, Brasher was the steeplechase. You're right. I'm sorry.
Chataway became the world record holder for the 5,000 meters.
Right.
So an absolutely legit runner who, maybe if Bannister hadn't been the sort of titan, maybe Chataway would have been the guy they got under four. But he went over to Finland. He wanted to break 4 minutes himself. So he raced. He pushed Landy past the three-quarter mile mark. And that's when Landy broke it. So it's like there were all sorts of reasons you could expect that would have been the day that Landy would have done it, aside from the mental part. Now, I do think that there is a mental part. I don't think it's a coincidence that Landy broke 4 minutes, 6 weeks after Bannister, and that then four other people did it within a year, and it started to sort of snowball from there. But it's not all in your head. Like, there's always a physical part and a mental part. And so hopefully, what I tried to do in the book was not kind of reduce it to a cereal box top message, or a Lululemon bag slogan, where it's like, oh yeah, all you have to do is think good thoughts and you're going to be able to conquer the world.
Right. Right. No, it's a complicated picture. You talk a lot early on in the book about Tim Noakes. I wanted to touch on that and some of the other researchers that you talk about. But you have an interesting part where you actually went over to South Africa and you did some work in Dr. Noakes's lab. And actually, you and Ross Tucker are the two like scientist athletes that I like to read online and I follow on Twitter and everything else. And you actually went over and you were like, Ross Tucker's in the book when he was still a graduate student rather, in Tim Noakes's lab, which I thought was just fantastic, because I feel like you guys have kind of the same approach to a lot of the problems that we talk about in the sport.
It was really neat to the University of Cape Town, where Tim Noakes, he recently retired, I guess, but where he was and where, Ross came through as a grad student and postdoc, it really felt like a kind of temple of exercise physiology. And and getting the chance to meet Ross and also the other students and postdocs there who've kind of spread throughout the world since then. It was like, you know, I was there for a week, and it's like every moment I was going to meet some new someone new who was doing something amazing, and they were all pushing limits in you know, the limits of research in different ways. So yeah, that was a really, really fantastic trip.
And what you get from reading that part of the book is these guys knew that they were changing the face of exercise science, but they also, they knew they were right. They didn't really seem to have any qualms about the fact that they were just challenging all these paradigms. They were just like, well, this is ultimately going to be proven to be correct.
Yeah. And it's interesting. It's interesting what has happened since then. Because Noakes really rewrote the books in a lot of areas in terms of the role of the brain in exercise, but also in terms of things like hydration and hyponatremia, and
right.
So now right now he's very prominent in you know, the idea that carbohydrates are a you know, a bad poison, and it's caused a lot of people, including me, to sort of you know, when someone's an iconoclast who challenges conventional wisdom and is very, very sure about himself, if you agree with him, you think, man, this guy's a hero. He's speaking truth to power. And if you find yourself not necessarily agreeing with him, you think, this guy's crazy. What's he talking about? So it's really been an interesting, you know, because of course Noakes has always provoked very strong reactions from people he disagrees with. And you know, initially when I would read the dehydration literature or whatever, and I think, how can anyone not see that Noakes is right? These guys are all just crazy. And now when you know, where I sort of see myself not agreeing with him, I think, oh, I kind of see what critics were saying before, that you know, he's so sure of himself that he's maybe not giving a fair shake to opposing arguments. But anyway, and similar, I think if you talk to Ross, you would get a similar sort of evaluation of that, where it's saying, yeah, they were, as you say, they were, you get the sense they were very, very sure they were right and everyone else was wrong. And Ross would say, yeah, maybe that wasn't the most constructive way of sort of moving the field forward. So it's interesting. Like, I one of the quotes I put in the book is from Carl Foster, who's you know, a former head of the American College of Sports Medicine, very prominent researcher,
giant in the field of exercise physiology research.
Exactly. And he says, you know, listen, Noakes has a particular personality that, you know, he likes to create controversy, but maybe that's sometimes what you need in order to shake up a field, that if it's stuck in a rut, you need someone who's willing to make enemies. And even if that person is not right in every respect, they at least force everyone else to think very carefully about the sort of assumptions that they've taken on board without maybe realizing it.
Right. One of my favorite scenes in that part of the book is where he's at a conference, I think before the New York City Marathon, and everyone's going off on, this is the running boom, everyone's going off on the health benefits of running and jogging, and isn't this so great? And he gets up and presents a case study of a marathoner who had a heart attack. It was just, yeah, he just liked twisting the knife a little bit.
And that was 1976, when Noakes was like, I can't remember if he was a med student or had just finished medical school. So it's like this element of his personality of like, whatever everyone's saying, I'm going to find the opposite, the evidence for the opposite. That this goes back. It's obviously deeply rooted in his personality. It's just the way he thinks as a scientist.
So as a low carb athlete now, I am obviously I'm throwing in my hat with him, just like, well, he was right about the other thing, and he'll be right about this too. But
it is interesting. I look at the areas where he had an autobiography a few years ago, and it basically goes through the various paradigms he's challenged, and it's like, I'm with him through the first six. It's like, huh? So, you know, if I'm a smart man, I would say, well, if he's 6 for 6, why not assume that he's 7 for 7? But as you know, like having read the book, you know, I do discuss the you know, the fuel issue, the low carb versus high carb. And
yes,
I think there's a lot of interesting research there, and I think our understanding has definitely shifted in the last 10 years, contrary to my expectations, and I'm sure contrary to everyone else's expectations, that carbs aren't this sort of, it's not like impossible to run ultra endurance without carbs. In fact, it may be the opposite, but I think there's still a lot to learn. So I'm sort of wary of prejudging the fight before we have all the evidence.
I agree. I mean, it's certainly an issue, just like any of these issues really, that, you know, when we're having to challenge our deeply held beliefs, And it makes us uncomfortable, and we tend to push back. And this is an issue in obviously lots of different areas of society. But I agree with you. I think the jury is still out, not just on the, you know, carbs versus fat, but if you want to talk about almost anything nutritional in terms of endurance or in terms of just our day-to-day lives, there's just so much more that we don't understand and a lot more research to be done. From a low-carb perspective, I tend to think that the real studies, or the studies that are going to examine what the proponents of low carb feel are the benefits, those studies haven't really been done yet. Nobody's put people on treadmills for 6 or 8 hours at a time, and it's going to be a while until we kind of understand the difference there. But that's not the point of the podcast. So
well, that could be a whole nother one.
But we could go down that rabbit hole forever. Noakes obviously plays an important role in the book, but the researcher who I wasn't as familiar with, who I think kind of becomes even more important as we read on, is Samuel Marcora, as I'm reading the part where he's I think doing research on motorcyclists on the Silk Road to the Far East, but I'm agreeing more and more with his conclusions in his model, which you term the psychobiological model. Can you talk a little bit about Marcora's model, how that kind of... Well, actually, you know what? Before we do that, let's talk for a second about Noakes' model, the central governor model, because I think that people, for the most part, are aware of it, but for people out there who aren't as familiar, let's talk a little bit about what the central governor model means, and then how does that contrast with, first of all, the traditional model of exercise science that he was challenging, and then we'll get into a little bit of Marcora's ideas and how those are different.
Yeah, so I guess the first thing to say is... Every brief summary oversimplifies everyone's views. So,
for sure.
So with that caveat out of the way, the 20th century was a great century for physiology in terms of understanding the human body as a machine, of understanding the parts of the engine, like the VO2 max, how quickly you can deliver oxygen to your muscles and use it, your lactate threshold, your running economy, sort of like the fuel mileage of your car, and you can basically construct a model where if you know these quantities, you can say, I can calculate how fast someone's going to be able to run a marathon, for example. And that model works really well up to a point. You know, if you take a random sample of the population and put them in the lab, do some tests, you'll be able to say, yeah, this guy's going to smoke this other person in a marathon.
Right.
But if you take a bunch of people who are relatively evenly matched, like well-trained runners, you find that it, no matter how many tests you do, you can't really figure out who's going to win a race. And so you kind of know intuitively, well, the brain matters, but no one had really incorporated the brain into these models to be able to sort of quantify or really understand how it is that the brain determines the winner of the race. And so this is in the 90s, Tim Noakes started to challenge this, the traditional model. And he was saying, this is a brainless model of exercise. It doesn't include the brain. Now, what he proposed is that there's something called, or there's a, his model is called the central governor model, based, and the idea is basically we are hardwired to protect ourselves, that when you're approaching a real physical limit, which could put your body in danger, your brain automatically and against your will holds you back. So it actually, for example, might reduce the signals from your brain to your muscles. So you're trying just as hard as you were before, but your brain is sending weaker and weaker signals to your muscles so that you can't push yourself right to the physical edge. So fundamentally, the central governor is a self-protection mechanism that prevents you from doing harm to yourself. Now, the model has evolved a bunch of times over the years, so it means a lot of things to different people. Basically, it's come to mean that the central governor just means your brain won't let you push yourself right to the limit. But some of the arguments are around the different ways that people define how that's working or exactly what the details are.
Right.
Sorry,
go on.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, yeah, it's come to stand in for the idea that the brain limits performance. But people like Marcora would say, well, no, the central governor is a specific model. And so it's not just, you know, if you agree that the brain is involved in performance, therefore the central governor is right. The central governor has specific features, like it's anticipating how far or fast you're going to go. It's against your will and unconsciously changing your ability to continue to hold you back. And so that that's different. That's more, that's saying more specific things than just the brain is involved in exercise.
Right. So Marcora's model that you describe, or I don't know if he termed it or you termed it the psychobiological model, where...
That's his words. Yeah.
That's his words. That's, okay. Yeah. So there's a really nice diagram in the book that I'm looking at right now, where basically instead of muscle fatigue being the primary determinant of the limitation of exercise and kind of the sense of effort or the idea of fatigue being kind of a byproduct of that, what he posits is that your perception of fatigue, your sense of effort is contributed to by the muscles, but or by muscular fatigue or by muscular breakdown, but also by many other psychological and non-psychological factors. And it's all of those things contributing to your sense of effort that ultimately cause the decision to stop. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so the fundamental piece is that you stop or slow down or speed up based on your subjective perception of effort, of how hard it feels. Now, this, of course, it matters how tired your legs are or how hard your heart is beating, but you don't slow down because your legs are unable to go or your heart can't beat any faster. You slow down because your legs are telling your tired legs are contributing to the sense that this is pretty hard, and therefore you make the decision, the conscious and voluntary decision to slow down. And this is, it kind of sounds like a semantic difference, like okay, who cares where the arrows go on that flow chart? But what it means is that anything else that affects your sense of effort can also influence your physical limits without making any changes to your muscles or your lactate or your heart rate. So the sort of simple example that's been floating around in the last few months because of Eliud Kipchoge is that if you smile, there's some evidence that it can alter your, it's kind of one of those things where if you smile, you create the emotion that normally makes you smile. So it makes things feel easier, and you can maybe change your perception of effort and thus perform better just by smiling, even though you haven't changed anything, below the neck.
Right. That's come up in other interviews that I've heard in the past with different ultra runners who will say, you know, even if I feel crummy coming into an aid station, I always smile when I'm talking to the volunteers. And it's just the act of smiling or just changing the idea of what's happening in your brain that actually makes the effort feel a little bit less intense.
Yeah, and this is a great example of something. It's like you hear, you ask Eliud Kipchoge, why do you smile late in a marathon when it hurts? And he's like, I run with my heart and my mind as much as my legs, and smiling helps to alter, how my legs feel. And that's exactly the kind of thing that, as a fairly analytical guy, I would have just sort of dismissed as a bunch of crap, frankly, for a long time. But it's like going through the process of researching this book has forced me to read the literature and look at new studies from people like Marcora and other researchers and say, oh, actually, first of all, there's evidence that it actually works in the lab. You can see changes in performance when runners are told to smile.
Right, or forced to smile by holding something in their teeth as one of the
studies. Yeah, so sometimes they don't even know that they're smiling, and right, yet their performance changes. And second of all, there's a theoretical framework that kind of explains why it's reasonable that this should happen. So it's not just an unexplained observation. It's like, yes, if Marcora's model is right, then it makes sense that if you're able to generate a positive emotion, then that can alter your perception of what's going on in your legs and your heart, and that can allow you to push a little harder. So it's been interesting to me to sort of reevaluate some of these things that, as you say, like, this is not, ultra runners and many other athletes have said things like, like Chrissy Wellington, the I think the Ironman triathlete.
Yep.
Her Twitter handle is like Chrissy Smiles. Like, she's famous for smiling during races.
Right.
But it's like, so it's, this isn't news to some people, but the fact that there's science to back it up and to explain it is news to me, at least. And it's kind of what, it makes it easier for me to try and implement some of these ideas, thinking that there's science behind it, than just because some fast guy or fast, man or woman, tells me that that's what they do. Because great athletes have lots of ideas about what works for them, and not all of them are true. There's David Epstein had a great quote a while ago, on this kind of debate, saying, just because you're a bird doesn't mean you're an ornithologist. And, so there are a lot of people who are extremely talented athletes who do things, amazing things, but you know, and Tom Brady leaps to mind. They may not have a lot of insight into what it is that makes them amazing, and so I'm skeptical until I see some evidence. And so that's kind of one of the journeys that I was on through this book.
So as somebody with an interest in physiology and a working knowledge of the kind of what we might call the more physical limits, is this model the way that we kind of can integrate these two things together, like the power of the mind, the kind of mind-centric view of endurance, but also still incorporating the like what we know, like you said, from hundreds or 100 years of exercise research to be important factors in terms of determining performance, VO2 and economy and those sort of things? Is that how you kind of view it, to relate these two kind of, I don't want to say competing, but different models of performance together?
Yeah, I think it seems to work pretty well that way. And one of the things Mark Hora says, you know, in one of his critiques of some other models and what he thinks is important in his model is, it's like, if you have a model, a successful model to explain endurance, it has to be able to explain both why something like smiling works and why like drinking a carbohydrate drink or whatever other physiological tools you want to talk about, has to be able to explain all those things with the same theory. If you have to have a separate theory for how the body's limits work and how the mind's limits work, that doesn't make sense.
Right.
So I think Mark Hora's model is very powerful. I think it fits or fulfills a lot of, you know, that kind of criteria. One of the dangers, or one of the sort of things for me where I sort of remain cautious, is Mark Hora is a really, really persuasive speaker. Anytime I speak to Mark Hora, I end up totally convinced that he's right about everything in the world. and it's hard to maintain any doubts after I speak to him, because he's just very good at explaining things. But when I speak to other people, then sometimes, you know, like Andy Jones is a great researcher who was involved in the Nike project. He's mm-hmm. kind of beet juice guy at the University of Exeter. He worked a lot with Paula Radcliffe. Right. He has different views. And when I speak to him, he makes a lot of sense too. So, you know, in a sense, in writing the book, I was kind of like, okay, I'm turning off my phone now and I'm trying to think this through for myself. And and that's where, you know, my deep ultimate conclusion is, I'm not really sure yet. I don't know. I think Mark Hora's model has a huge amount of, a lot to say for it. I find it very compelling. I think if you talk to Ross Tucker, he'd say, actually, Mark Hora's model is not really any different from what we've been saying all along, with different words.
Right.
And it's hard to sort of sort these out. You know, this is actually a very sort of kind of vicious and sadly personal debate now between these various factions. So I don't know what the answer is, and I'm not confident enough to be able to proclaim a winner. But I will say I find Mark Hora's theoretical framework and the experiments he's done to support his theoretical framework, I find them very, very interesting and very compelling.
So without, you know, obviously we're not going to solve the question today, but granting that the mind plays a central role in determination of endurance and performance in athletics, what are the best ways? Any coach can train or can write up a training program to address the physiologic parameters that we've been discussing, the VO2 max and that sort of thing. And there are volumes and volumes written on that. What are the best ways to kind of develop this kind of mind-centric, I don't want to say paradigm, but what are the ways that we can train our own minds, train our own psychology or beliefs to kind of take advantage of what we're learning about the importance of the mind?
Yeah, so... Excuse me. There are a few different ways, ranging from complex and difficult to fairly straightforward. And you know, I have a chapter on things like brain training. Mark Hora has been developing this paradigm or this technique of using computer-based brain endurance training. It's interesting. It has some promising results. I tried it. It's hard. It's not something I think that is going to catch on and be like the wave of the future, because it's very labor intensive. You got to really want that extra 1% performance or whatever.
Right.
So the number one piece of advice I would give, and the one that if I had a time machine, I would get, you know, I would go back and give myself, is to try some fairly straightforward sports psychology techniques, in particular motivational self-talk. And that's, again, that's something that's been around for a while, but it's not, now there's starting to be studies that really validate it, in my eyes at least. Marcora has done studies showing that motivational self-talk training enhances performance. And in fact, there's a really neat study by a guy named Stephen Chung at Brock University, where he put cyclists in a heat chamber and had them pedal to exhaustion. And then he gave them 2 weeks of self-talk training. And so what that means is, first of all, they have to become aware of the internal monologue in their head. They have to say, okay, when I'm sort of getting tired, reaching exhaustion, what is it? What are the words going on in my mind? Is it, oh God, I'm way too hot. Oh, this is impossible. I can't do this. I'm burning up.
Right.
And then you have to, so identifying them, being aware of them is the first stage. And like in general, you then have to kind of wrestle with those negative thoughts and say, are they real? Like if you're saying to yourself, oh, this is too hard. I'm screwed. I didn't do enough long runs. Well, it's like, if you didn't do enough long runs, then you can't just change your internal monologue if your internal monologue is right. So if your internal monologue is telling you something about your lack of preparation, then okay, first of all, you need to fix your preparation. But a lot of times your internal monologue is telling you things that are not necessarily right or unnecessarily negative. And you want to try and say, okay, what could I say instead at that point? So you work on ideas like saying things like, okay, at the halfway mark, I'm going to say, keep pushing, you're ready for this. And at the three quarters mark, I'm going to say, you know, you're almost there, you know, whatever it is that will motivate you. And it's not, there's no formula on what works best for everyone. So you have to drop a list of things you might say, then you have to go out in workouts and try them out, see what feels normal, natural, helpful to you, identify a few key phrases, and then implement them in competition and in hard workouts. And so in Stephen Chung's study, what he found is that the self-taught training, specifically altering their internal language around like how hot they were and whether they could keep going. First of all, it boosted time to exhaustion in a test from like, I think it was 8 minutes to 11 minutes in the particular test he was doing. But more interestingly, it allowed the cyclists to push their core temperature about a half a degree higher. So it's like, it's not just a placebo effect. They were pushing deeper into their physiological reserve using this really quite straightforward psychological technique. This like motivational self-talk training, you know, it's like you get a half hour session and some worksheets to write down the things that are in your head. You practice them a bit, and a couple of weeks later, bada boom, bada bing, you've altered your limits to some extent. So right. I think that's something that's applicable, like for runners, for endurance athletes in general, for life in general too, in a way.
And like you said, that's not new. We've been kind of talking about this for 20 or 30 years, but I think like you, and you said in the book, you had a sports psychologist come into your collegiate team, and you guys, it was a kind of a joke. And we had this, I had the same experience when I was doing running camps in high school and when I was running in college. Yeah, it was always kind of, you know, you'd half laugh your way through it. And if only we'd realized the power of it then, you know, it might have been different, because it is something that needs practice. It's not something that you can just kind of pull out of your pocket when the going gets tough on race day. It's something that needs to kind of become, you know, second nature to you. And to reframe those negative thoughts in the heat of the moment is very difficult to do unless you're, you know, practiced at it, basically.
Yeah, exactly. It's got to be ingrained so that it comes naturally, because you don't have mental bandwidth to spare when you're actually in the race. And you kind of have to, like, I don't want to make it sound like a religion, but you kind of have to believe in it too. And right. So this was what was holding me back. It's like, you know, I could listen to the sports psychologist, and it's like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. I guess it's probably true. But if you don't really buy it, you're going to be always half-assing it. And so for me, kind of the journey of researching and writing this book is like, I guess actually, you know, I actually really believe it now. I believe that the motivational self-talk can help. And even though I've been aware of it forever, and it's not like I actively thought it was, you know, not true, but I just never was really bought into it.
Right.
And if you're going to invest the time, you have to have bought into it before you start. But otherwise, you're never going to, you know, buy into it enough to invest the time to make it come automatically to you in race situations.
Do you think being conscious of what you're doing, I mean, I don't want to say you get self-conscious about it, but for example, like with the smiling thing that we were talking about, So now if I try and use that in a race and I try and make myself smile, in the back of my head, I'm almost like, I'm a little bit too conscious of what I'm trying to do. And I feel like that sometimes that kind of diminishes the effects, as if I was just doing it more naturally, I might feel better about it. And maybe I'm just too cynical and I'm just like, you're just doing what you've heard that you're supposed to do.
Yeah. You know, and I don't have like a straightforward or an easy answer to that, because I'm the same. Like I feel if I try smiling when I'm out for a run, I feel a little self-conscious of like what a silly gimmick this is.
Right.
And I don't, you know, I don't think there's necessarily any easy way to get around that, other than that if you think it's worthwhile to keep doing it until you're less conscious of it. I mean, for me, this is one of those things where like I'm not like super competitive right now. I'm in a stage where I have couple of young kids and I'm more focused on babysitting than hard training, but I do race and I'm not doing like a systematic motivational self-talk thing, but I'm trying to become more aware of the thoughts but also facial expressions. So I'm not out there grinning, but I do notice, it's like, you know, if I'm doing a tempo run or whatever, I tend to have this like contorted grimace of despair on my face.
Right.
And it's like, okay, maybe before I worry about smiling, the first thing I'm going to do is try to notice periodically, check every mile. And it's like, if I have the contorted grimace of despair, just at least relax my face.
Right.
That's like halfway there, so that I'm not like, you know, I'm not creating this state where I'm making it feel harder than it needs to be.
Right.
So maybe there's some baby steps.
Ways. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I have just one more little gimmick that we're going to go through. I'm going to make you my guinea pig on a new segment that we're calling, On a Desert Island, okay? So you're going to a desert island. I want you to tell them for, I don't know, a year. I want you to give me one book, one album, one food, and one beer that you're bringing with you.
Okay, let me see. The first thing is a book. Boy, for a year. You know what? Like the book that I've probably read most in the world and has stood up the best to rereading is, I hate to be cliched, is Once a Runner.
That is not a cliche. That is fantastic.
I had it on my bookshelf when I was in college, and I actually just would read a chapter from it every night before bed for like 2 or 3 years. So there was a point where I pretty much knew it off by heart.
Oh yeah, no, I was there for sure. So actually,
go ahead.
No, I used to work these running camps in North Carolina and up in Vermont, and one of the guys I met there who was very influential on my career later on, he was good friends with John Parker. And one year, one year he got John Parker to come, and he was at camp with us for like 3 weeks, I think. So my copy is autographed and everything else. What as an aside, what did you think about the sequel? Have you read the sequel?
I read it once and I couldn't bring myself to read it again. And realistically, there was almost nothing any human could do to make me not be disappointed with it. I wasn't like disappointed with it. I enjoyed reading it, but I couldn't read it again. Like,
yeah.
I've got too much of the original.
Yeah. No, I have not reread it.
To accept any developments.
I haven't reread it either, but I think I read it at the right time in my life, that it hit me very poignantly. And it was right. I mean, nothing will ever measure up to the original, obviously, but I really enjoyed it. It kind of hit me in a different way than the original book did. And, you know,
yeah, it's nice when authors when characters grow up in the same way or at the same rate as you.
Yeah,
do.
Exactly.
And now he's a little older, and I'll read about him when he's a little older.
Yeah, it's that's like, exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it was good. But
good. One book, one album. Give me one album.
Album for me would probably be Miles Davis, the album "Relaxin'" with the Miles Davis Quintet.
Nice.
It's very relaxing, but also it's what I used to listen to before races too. There's a couple of tunes there that really pump me up.
One food,
which I know. One food, probably it would have to be like a pasta dish or just a big massive block of cheese. One of those two, or maybe both. Maybe pasta with a massive block of cheese on top.
All right, we'll allow it. And one beer.
One beer. I might have to go with there's a Toronto beer called Steam Whistle, which I'm partial to.
It sounds delicious. What kind of beer is it? I mean, what variety is it?
It's an IPA.
Okay. Awesome. Alex, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you have a busy day. I was first in line today, but I know you've got other interviews coming up. So thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. The book is called Endure: Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. Where should people buy it other than Amazon? Do you have a preference where they go to get it?
Anywhere where books are sold. I mean, obviously, support your local bookstore or even your local running store. They may be able to order it. But as far as I'm concerned, anywhere you buy it, even unless it's off the street and photocopied, I'm thrilled.
Thank you so much, Alex. Thank you for listening, everybody out there. If you want to get in touch with us, you can through our website. That's gunksrunner.com/paincave. You can hit the contact button, follow the Pain Cave on Facebook, follow me on Twitter and Instagram at gunksrunner. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play. Leave us a review if it's a positive one. If it's not, I don't know. I guess you can leave it anyway. I just won't be very happy about it. Thanks so much to Alex and to everyone out there. And until next time in the Pain Cave, just keep putting one foot in front of the other.
Broken down and beaten up. The years have been long and tough, but I'm not dead. Happy now just to spend some time with friends and have a roof above my head. I'm not jaded, just been faded like a good old pair of jeans. Rusted like a proud old car that's drove a little too far and seen too much rain. But long ago, as a child, I look about the night sky in wild wonder, man. Then ride the bus and feel upset to think of all the years I'd have to go through there. I was still young. I was still young.
That's good for me. Let me hear you.
1, 2, 3. This is Alex. I had potatoes for breakfast. Yada yada yada.
You had potatoes for breakfast?
No, I didn't. But people keep everyone. Whenever people do sound checks, they want me to say something with P in it to see if to check
Oh,
my
for the pop.
plosives.
Yeah.